must start. Now, I've said this to you in person before, but for all the listeners, a big congratulations.
Thanks. I'm not pregnant anymore.
That's the most exciting thing. Yes, if I was still pregnant, I would have been very, very grumpy at this stage. But no, a week ago she arrived. So we're all feeling good, really. So yeah, very exciting.
How does it feel as a going from a family of three to a family of four? Massive difference. Because see, mine came within 3 minutes of each other. So that was that. How big so far or not has that changed from three to four?
Yeah, not a massive jump, really. I mean, because your life is already about a child. It's just now about two. So, you know, the difference of the first one, I think, is definitely more because your life is dramatically changing. Whereas it is not so much. It's just a little bit more to deal with. But there you go. So yeah, no, it's all good. So I won't bore people with all the gory details, although some people love it. They love hearing
all
the gory details.
I don't.
Okay, you're not that sort of audience. I know we've got a lot of ish in 10ish, but that might be too far.
No, I think we'd have to put some kind of warning. You know, I don't know if podcasts have like ratings. You know, sometimes I listen to a podcast and it says, not advisable for anyone, you know, I like my crime stuff, of like 13 and under or 13 or whatever. I'd have to put one of those if you started going down a road that, and I might listen to crime podcasts, but it doesn't mean I like that stuff. I don't like that stuff. And I never want to listen to that stuff. So apologies.
I'm happy to not talk about it
to any listener who wanted to hear that. I really apologize that I'm going to move things on, but does it make you, I'm wondering, as a former full-time professional athlete, tennis player, and I know this is your second child, not your first, but does it still leave you slightly in awe, or do you think it would be doable as to how these athletes go through everything and it's a massive change for the body and then get back to playing at an elite or somewhere near an elite level?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's very impressive. I think more just, I think a lot of parents will agree that the biggest problem is just general logistics of babies and children and trying to work. And if you're an athlete, you're trying to train. It's more just the time it takes, because when you're an athlete, it's your entire life. And then, of course, when you have a kid, it can't be. Your kid's your entire life, really. And you're trying to squeeze stuff around. So I think that's the big thing. I can totally see how, you know, the body does it. I think it's definitely much more difficult in your 30s than it is, say, in your 20s in comparison to, say, someone like Kim Clijsters doing it, or now Naomi Osaka is doing it. But I think it's just the how do you do that? How do you do family life and full-time athlete life in a sport where you travel from country to country to country, week after week after week? You don't stay anywhere for longer than a couple of weeks. And that's the thing that I just don't understand. I don't understand how they do it. It's unbelievably impressive. And yeah, you could maybe argue, of course, you know, I think a lot of it depends on, I suppose, the partner, the help that you've got. You can't, you know, it's very difficult to do it on your own. You need to, you know, bring people along with you. But yeah, it's difficult. You know, it's not easy. I remember, was it Marin Cilic talking about how, you know, his baby wasn't sleeping at night, but they're all in the same room and he's at a tournament. And, you know, because you have to juggle, you have to make those choices. Do you get your own room? And but then what's the point in your family being there if you're not going to spend the time with them? So, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
And it's about being selfish, isn't it, as an athlete at the top of your game? It's about, I'm eating what I need to eat, I'm eating what I need to eat, I'm sleeping when I need to sleep, I'm not going to do this, I'm going to do that, because it's all about keeping yourself in the condition to go out there and win the matches. And then suddenly you've got a little one, and your little one now, this is our second go. Actually, no, I can't blame the little one for this being the second go at trying to do the pod.
Yeah,
that was
harsh.
A battery failure on your part.
Yeah, I had no batteries.
In the sense, you know, suddenly if she wants something, she's not going to be like, okay, I'm going to wait till you finish recording, which maybe baby Rog might start to kind of get a handle on doing, and my two are sort of getting to the stage where they will. They'll just do it whenever they want to do it. So can't be as selfish as you were or need to be.
And that's it really, isn't it? So I do find it incredibly impressive, the people that can just live that life on tour and juggle it all. That's the thing that's it's really difficult. And I think for a lot of people, it changes your perspective on things, doesn't it? You know, when it comes to just what's important and how much you stress over wins and losses and all that sort of stuff. So, but there's more and more parents on tour, I think, more and more men and women.
And I know it doesn't matter how much money you have. Look, it's easier if you're a Serena Williams or a Roger Federer or whatever traveling with children, because you've got the money to make it a lot more comfortable and you don't have to probably squeeze into one room. But for me, it's the flight. I mean, flying there are actually, they love flying and they're straightforward, but it's just the planning and the organising. I'm already, you know, you're already thinking, hey, what do we need to get through this with us? And I think it's just the extra planning and the everything that goes with it just makes me really admire those people who are taking their family on tour. But at the same time, do you know what I mean? What's the point of having a family if you're not going to see them?
That's it. That's the juggle. But it's the same for everyone, isn't it? You know, whether it's us working, anyone working, you know, we have to travel for our job sometimes. And, you know, it's always that balance. And you always feel like it's slightly off in one direction. It's either not quite enough on the work side or it's not quite enough on the family. It's never going to be perfectly balanced. So, yeah. It's the same for everyone, really.
So in terms of the Australian Open, that now seems quite a long time ago, how much of the back end of it, because I know you were very grumpy because you were very uncomfortable, how much of it were you keeping across towards the end?
Yeah, I watched it all, really. You know, very much enjoyed the finals in their own unique ways. And I thought it was a fabulous tournament. I think I really enjoyed it. So much drama from the start, lots of different stories, and then we just had what a final that was. I think on the women's side it was absolutely extraordinary. It was such a great match, everything you hope for, because sometimes when you get two big hitters, it was Rybakina and Sabalenka, well, when you get two big hitters, it can fall flat. It can be very short points. They can just be a little bit off balance in terms of what they're trying to deliver, how early in the points they're trying to deliver it, because they're just so desperate to get the first strike in. But we didn't have any of that at all. It was you know, the way that the best big baseline hitting can be, really. But no, I loved it. The whole tournament, I thought, was fab. Really enjoyed it.
I think with Sabalenka, so many people have been just willing this for her for so long, because she's been knocking on the door and she's got the game, but with the nerves going to take hold, with a double fault going to creep in. But I think for Rybakina, I'm really pleased for her, because she's genuinely a quieter person. And I know she wasn't happy that being the Wimbledon champion, and obviously there were no points, so she wasn't getting, in terms of the draw, she wasn't getting those because she was still kind of making her way up. She wasn't happy being on court 13, 14, 15. And fair enough, she's a Wimbledon champion. But I'm happy for her that she made it through to that final and people got to know her a little bit more. Like, she was talking about gymnastics and ice skating. I feel she's starting to open up a little bit more, and we're getting to know a bit more of her personality. And together with that, she's now got the points to reflect the tennis that she's playing.
Yeah, and do you know what it is? And it's such a funny thing. It's almost like she's not trying as hard in herself. She's sort of, you know, that's maturing, isn't it? That's growing up. She knows who she is a bit more. You know, she's been so desperate for it for such a long time. And I think she's just sort of accepted that, okay, it's achievable. This is how we're going to do it. And, you know, just execute. And she's taking control of her own psychology, saying that she's her own psychologist now. And, you know, just made some really smart decisions. And I think the really big thing that is very difficult for players to do, and it really shows the maturity and the fact that you're ready. And it's no surprise that this story came out when her coach had said to her, "Yeah, I don't think I can give you any more." And she was saying, "No, no, it's not you. Like, you know, I don't need to change my coach. Like, I need to sort this out."
Hang on, so this is Sabalenka, right? Because I was just waffling away there about Rybakina.
Oh!
And what she had done. And
oh, let's blame it on massive, baby brain.
They're both massive hitters of the ball. And you can have baby brain, because she's still very, very young. I was claiming it 2 years later and I cannot have baby brain there. But they've got similar styles, and you feel like they've gone through similar trials. But as you say, with Sabalenka and her team, a big thing for her is she's stuck by the team that said, maybe you need a different team.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's finish up on Sabalenka first then. And we'll circle back to Rybakina. Sorry, Elena. It's terribly rude of me.
She's been put on court 15.
Yeah.
I give her the big up and you stick her back on court 15.
Yeah, start talking about Sabalenka. I mean, to be fair, Sabalenka did win, so she trumps it. But anyway, yeah, that must have been very confusing for everybody for a little while. So I think, you know, for Sabalenka, you know, she's been so desperate for it for a long time. Just trying that little bit less has really helped. And for Rybakina, you know, she was talking about how you always have those doubts as to whether it was a bit of a fluke at Wimbledon. But I think the rest of the tennis world knew Rybakina was coming. You know, we'd seen her for such a long time. We knew she was
coming. Pre-COVID, she was on that phenomenal run pre-COVID. She'd won tournament. And when it shut down, I remember a lot of discussions where someone who's really going to suffer from this is Rybakina, because she was making this almighty charge. And then suddenly, everything stopped.
Yeah, no, it was... It was difficult for everybody, of course, to have that enforced break. But for certain people, it really did impact them badly. And she absolutely was one of them. But, you know, her game is just unquestionable. I mean, the strike is just... it is so effortless. Everything about her is so quiet. And the personality doesn't really match the game on the court, does it? But, my God, it packs a punch. So, delighted to see that she's, you know, been able to get into top 10 where she belongs.
And it was interesting that following the final, she felt the need on social media to write a statement, a letter, a note. I don't know how we want to categorise it. Defending her coach. Now he's a fiery fella, and maybe he seems all the more fiery because she's so placid while she's out on court. But he really takes it to another level. And she felt the need to, because there were lots of people saying he's got to back off, he's got to stop, it's not healthy, it's not right. And it might not be, I don't know the ins and outs, but she felt the need to put out a statement just to say, look, this guy believed in me all those years ago. He's my first full-time coach. It comes back to this complexity of the coaching-student relationship and where the power lies. But I thought it was interesting that she felt the need to put something out just to say, look, guys, just back off.
There was a lot of chat, wasn't there, about it? And because you see, you know, if we're going to be really fair, you know, what we saw from him in the box was very negative, very constant. It didn't matter what the score was, how she was playing. It was all, it felt, you know, quite intense, quite negative. And I know people who were actually there and were very close to the box, and they were saying it's even worse when you're here and you can see it and feel it. Than what you see on TV when you're just getting glimpses here and there. So that was the impression that I think people were getting from sort of back home. But in his defence, we are seeing him in a very highly stressed state. It is, you know, coaches are as stressed, if not more stressed, than the players on the court. I mean, especially Rybakina doesn't seem stressed at all, to be honest. So maybe he's just he's just doing all of the nerves and all of the stress for them. You know, he says that she needs energy. And sure, you can argue maybe different energy, not quite so negative. And, you know, it wouldn't work for me. Maybe it works for somebody else. You know, you had a lot of people commenting saying that there's just no place for it at all, really. It's just not how you should speak to somebody in a professional capacity. But what we don't know is he could be unbelievably positive off the court, and he could be the first person after that match to give her a big hug and say, you were brilliant, I'm proud of you. And do all of the right things. It's just that in the moment, that is how they've learned to sort of deal with stress. You know, we watch players do it, don't we? We watch, you know, Andy Murray, we've seen him for years ranting and raving, so much energy going out and picking fights with himself, not really with anybody else. And the amount of times that people are sort of like, oh, if he could only just not do that, it's not a very good look. It's probably hindering his tennis, but that is how he's coping with the immense stress on the court. And so I mean, I'm not sort of making excuses for that behaviour. I don't understand why it's like that. I wouldn't accept that from my own coach. I wouldn't accept that from anybody I knew doing it. But as I say, it could be the case that, you know, he's perfectly great on the practice court, and it's just in matches that, you know, that's how it goes. She doesn't seem to be too bothered by it. As you say, she released that statement. I mean, it's difficult, really, isn't it, to know what's what. You only see a tiny glimpse of them on the court.
Yeah, it's like they always say, you don't know what's going on behind the curtains or behind the shutters, what is actually happening. You did, when you were talking about Sabalenka a couple of minutes back, you talked about that she said she was going to be her own psychologist, and she was ditching the psychology she had to figure out for herself. I don't know if you've seen this, but I was sort of signposted on social media to an interview that Jack Edward did, who's the creator of the On The Line podcast. Now, it was with Gavin McMillan, the biomechanics trainer that Aryna Sabalenka hired. And if anyone hasn't seen it, just Google his name or Google the On The Line podcast and have a look at it. It was just it was really interesting. And one of the lines he said of it, the biggest change wasn't her serve, it was her forehand. So she gets someone in just to completely break everything down and make the adjustments. And here we have a Grand Slam champion.
Yeah, and it doesn't always work. Sometimes, and I'm not trying to be sort of critical of biomechanics and people who do that sort of thing, but sometimes it makes the problem worse. When you break something down, you try and build it back up again, it ends up having some more weaknesses or more stress cracks than there were originally. So it's a bit of a risk as a tennis player to do that, and you'll feel incredibly vulnerable because there'll be a period of time where you don't know what's happening with your serve. You can barely throw your arm in the right direction because you're trying to hit all of the right points, and of course with her forehand as well. But you're forcing your arms to do something it doesn't want to do. You're forcing your body, the timing, all of it's different, and so you can just feel like, I don't know how to hit this shot anymore. It's a big risk, and we see plenty of players just not do it, don't we? We see plenty of players that they get the advice comes from the big ex pros like a Navratilova or somebody like that. I remember Navratilova saying about Ostapenko the year she won the French, it was at the end of the year at the tour finals, she said, she needs to start this serve from scratch, she needs to completely dismantle it and start all over again. She's not done that because Ostapenko will say, well, I've won a Grand Slam with this serve, so why would I need to change it? So it can be really difficult to really get on board. So huge credit to her for taking a risk, but also huge credit for making it work, because a lot of players, when they get into that headspace of my serve, it's been dismantled, but it has not yet been rebuilt. you don't know how to serve anymore. That is a very scary place to be, and people get stuck in it, and then they don't commit so much to rebuilding. They don't believe as much. They get uncertain or whatever it is, and that's when you're left with a serve that's probably equally as biomechanically clunky as it was before, or maybe worse. What a great effort for her to do it so quickly as well.
So there has to be an element of the mental in there as well. I know maybe a biomechanics person would say it's got nothing to do with the mental, and maybe the point he was making was it wasn't coming from her head, it was actually something structurally, physically that wasn't working. But then the mental side has to come into it, because you say she has to deal with the vulnerability of when it's broken down, and then have the belief that she can get it back to where it was, or hopefully in her case better than before.
Yeah, I mean, I've always believed that these things are a combination of, you have to have something technically wrong in your, if your serve or any shot is technically fine, it sort of doesn't really matter how nervous you get. It doesn't matter how bad things are mentally. It's just sort of fine. I can tell now. Obviously I don't play so much anymore, but I cannot play for 3 months, not touch a racket. I mean, my forehand, which has massive technical flaws, is all over the place. I'm basically hitting it in the floor. I can't do anything. But my backhand, which was always technically very, very sound and simple, is just rock solid. It just is absolutely fine. Like, there's no, it's just fine. It doesn't matter how much disruption I bring. So the focus is always on the forehand. I think it's always got to be a combination. So you have to have something technically wrong, some issues, and then those technical issues will be covered up when you're feeling confident and everything's fine, and those technical issues will be out on display for everyone to see when you are feeling really nervous or you get the yips or mentally you doubt yourself. So you've got to tackle both, but how do you not doubt yourself when you know you've got technical issues? So you can't just tackle one. You can't just say, it's all mental, I just need to mentally believe, because you're never going to truly believe when you're trying to, it's match point at the Australian Open, and you're serving for the championship, and you're like,
wow. Yeah,
I mean, how
yeah.
are you going to believe when you know that, well, my serve can go at any moment? It's just, it's not going to happen.
It's going to be interesting to see if more people go down that route, because there's been so much talk in recent times about psychologists. And as I say, Sabalenka said she ditched hers just because she said she's got to sort her own problems. But a big advocate of having a psychologist and it working is Iga Świątek. I mean, Daria Abramović is now heavily involved with the sort of day-to-day running of Iga Świątek's life, and it's something that she felt really helped her. And I read, there's Carol Bouchard did a really nice piece for Tennis Majors about Świątek and the moving into the other side, because you never really think of it like, and I know we've touched on this before, but she said most of her earnings have come on the court, but she wants to now explore off it. Max Eisenbud's come in to help her. She's signed with a big agency, but it has to be done on her terms. And I think she's such a smart cookie, Świątek. And I remember when she got that number one, she just looked so settled. She looked so calm. But I really like, and again, if people haven't seen it, sort of search out that article. It's a really nice piece on how she is trying to explore, trying to get the introvert in her and try and put it out there on a kind of bigger stage, which I think must be really hard if that is not naturally your personality.
Yeah, I think so. But good to see that she's trying to maximise. I do think that this is the time to do it. I'm not a businesswoman by any sense, but I don't think her stock is going to be higher. I can't see at the end of 2023 that she has double the amount of points of the number two in the world like she had at the end of 2022. Mm. She might still be number one in the world, don't get me wrong. She might still win a slam, but I don't think we're going to see her. We could see her knocked off number one. I mean, it absolutely could happen. I think we're seeing more players get a grip of her game. I talked about this before. There's been more time. There's more belief now amongst the rest of the top 10. So I don't think she's going to have as easy a time as she did last year. So now's the time to do it. Next few months, let's sign.
It is good, though, to challenge yourself. And she's putting herself in uncomfortable positions because it's not naturally her personality. And I think anyone in any stage, walk of life, especially as you get older. Did you know I'm learning Spanish? Have I told you that?
I did know you were learning Spanish.
Yeah. So,
I mean, I was going to try and say something in Spanish, but I realised that I have not learned Spanish. So I can't do that.
I'm only four lessons in and I missed two due to the Australian Open. But for me, that's a challenge because, and people might think it's weird because of the job that I do, but I find it, you know, in a room full of people, I'm quite shy. And for a teacher to point at me and suddenly say, say how you are and who you are and your profession and this in Spanish, I find that I'm like, oh my word, I get really nervous. And we're all in the same boat. We're this real eclectic bunch of people who've come together to learn this language. But it's a real challenge for me because I find those situations quite, you get really confident people. And I think they assume that, because you have to say what you do and everything, that I'm going to be really kind of loud and I'm not. So I think those kind of things, especially as you get older, it challenges the brain cells, the grey matter. I think I can get to 19, 20, I'm still figuring out. And I can tell you what my name is. I'm not going to. My profession, where I live and what I am in terms of I'm half English, half French. But I keep speaking French. I never realised my French was so good until I started taking Spanish.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but you speak French.
I know.
Your French is good.
But
you,
I didn't.
You speak French.
I didn't realise. And suddenly the teacher looks at you and says, you ask Mark over there. And you're thinking, oh my. Ah. So, yeah.
Do you not just get, like, when she asks you to say something in Spanish, do you not just get it all in French? Like, all the French words are coming out.
I start to say something in Spanish, then I add in a French word instead of, yeah. Or, yes, it's a real mishmash at the moment. I don't know what a mix of French and Spanish is, but that's what I seem to
you
be coming out.
You speak European.
Sounds quite glamorous, doesn't it? As I say, just those challenges, the kind of, because we all do those New Year's resolutions of, I don't know, eat less, exercise more. I don't know if people drink a lot, whatever. Do you know what I mean? So I thought this one, because I actually have to go for 2 hours to the local college every week. And so Iga Świątek, I salute you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Someone who's happy at putting himself out there, even if he's injured with a tear in his hamstring, is Novak Djokovic. I mean, it is quite... Look, I know in recent times he's missed a fair few opportunities to get that equal at Nadal's record and go past it eventually. But wow, I mean, he put his body on the line to win this Australian Open.
Yeah, and I think that it's probably something that you don't do when you're 25, but you do when you're 35, right? Because, like we saw with Nadal last year at the French, very much putting his body on the line as well with the foot situation. Well, you know, that might be his last chance to win the French. You just don't know. You don't know how physically it's going to go. I mean, Djokovic seems to be generally in better shape, but these I say niggles, it was a tear. but these injuries are becoming more frequent for the man who just seemed in the most ridiculous shape, the most flexible player, you know, extraordinary. I don't want to say physicality because, you know, Nadal has better physicality, but it just in terms of how his body has held up, how he would respond from five set matches, you know, whatever it was. I mean, he's pushed, I think, the sport physically to new levels. And but they are starting to creep in now more and more. He's having to do a lot more managing, I think, of the body. But ultimately, the slams, if you're in the slam, you're in the slam, right? You can compete and you can win it if you're Novak Djokovic. So you just do what you can to get to the end. And whatever consequences come after that, you have to sort of deal with, really.
I mean, he's still...
So not surprised.
He's still the best player in the world. I mean, we need Carlos Alcaraz to come back to see the challenge to Novak Djokovic. We know that Novak Djokovic, as things stand, he can go to the US Open, but the lifting of the ban, as it were, won't be in time for Indian Wells and Miami. But it's just those around him trying to... Yes, the body's breaking down a little bit more, but I don't know. Where is the challenge Carlos Alcaraz? Where else has the challenge Tsitsipas fell short? I think a few people were slightly surprised he didn't bring a different level to it. Daniil Medvedev was still wondering if he can get himself back up there. Zverev's still coming back from injury. Casper Ruud, you know, where is the challenge for you? Who's the closest to challenging Djokovic this year?
Well, I mean, you have to look at Alcaraz. I mean, let's assume that Nadal's just never going to be 100% fitness again. I mean, you have to look at Alcaraz, but he's only, you know, he's only very young and very inexperienced, really. So, unfortunately, there isn't. I mean, look, he just won the Australian Open with a torn hamstring. Nadal won the French with a numb foot. It's, you know, the gap is huge.
It's
ridiculous, though. Like,
yeah, it is.
Djokovic won Wimbledon. I mean, he sort of cruised it, really, didn't he? Because he was relatively fit. And this is where, ultimately, they still only need to find a 7 out of 10 to beat everyone and to beat people like Tsitsipas. And it was a real shame that Tsitsipas couldn't challenge challenge Djokovic in the final as well as he would have liked. Got off to a really slow start and it was, you know, going to be difficult. But I think, you know, going into that, I was excited because I'd picked Tsitsipas out of my word search.
So I'd
done quite well. But in comparison to the French, when he took on Djokovic in that final, that is different. It's Tsitsipas's favourite surface. It's Djokovic's least favourite surface. And, you know, just that couple of percent either way, an extra couple of percent for Tsitsipas because that's where he wants to be, and a couple of percent down for Djokovic because it's not his favourite court. I mean, you can see the difference between that French Open final where Tsitsipas genuinely did have a chance to win. He was two sets up and he was the better player for two sets of it. And then you suddenly put Djokovic on the Rod Laver Arena. And it's a different ball game. As I say, you have those couple of percentage point swing and, you know, Tsitsipas just can't live with him. Just couldn't live with him.
We got Nick Kyrgios battling back from injury, but he is the unknown quantity. I mean, looking at the live rankings at the moment, in order, it's Djokovic, Alcaraz, Tsitsipas, Ruud, Rublev, Nadal, Fritz, Felix Auger-Aliassime, Holger Rune, Hubert Hurkacz. I mean, Daniil Medvedev's now down to 11. I mean, it's there for Novak Djokovic, isn't it? If he wants to be the GOAT, if he believes the GOAT is how many Grand Slam titles you have won, it's his for the taking now, if he can stay fit.
Yeah, plenty more for him to get his hands on. You know, he's always favourite of the Australian Open, as long as he's 50% fit, I'd say. I don't know.
Wow.
He's always going to be favourite. The same at Wimbledon. At the French, obviously, you have a problem called Rafael Nadal. I'm going to assume, probably wrongly, I hope wrongly, but probably wrongly, that he's not going to be fit at the French, and that, you know, this seems like it's a, you know, big problem for for Nadal. And if that is the case, then I would love to be seeing a Djokovic-Ruud final, for example. Mm. I think that would be really interesting. Yes, Ruud got pretty walloped by Nadal at the French, but I think that him against Djokovic could be really fun on the clay. You know, it would be great to see Dominic Thiem back, wouldn't it, as well, to challenge on the clay. Can't see anyone challenging on the grass, apart from potentially Berrettini. But, you know, I don't know if he's playing consistently enough, but he's still got time to do it. I don't know. It's the US Open, really, is the one.
It's always,
the
isn't it?
One
it's
that, that anyone's got a chance with. But, yeah, I mean, he's just the best, isn't he?
No, he's absolutely phenomenal. Do you have an issue with wildcards? Do you mind or care who they're awarded to or how they're awarded? Recently, we had a little flurry of interest when Andy Murray was awarded a wildcard in Dubai, and it starts the conversations of should it go to people who need a break or a chance? Should it go to this? Should it go to that? Do you have any views on how wildcards are awarded?
It's up to the tournament. Yeah. It's the tournament's decision with the wildcards. Whoever's running the tournament gets the choice. And it's completely up to them. They get a few free spots because they are paying a lot of money to put on these tournaments and doing an awful lot. And in exchange, yes, they have the potential to make revenue, of course, but it's their tournament and they reserve a few spots for whoever the hell they want. And if they want a former champion like Andy Murray, who wouldn't, then bring him in. If they want to give it to a local player who's doing very well, then give them a chance, the best in the country. If they want to do a thing where we see it quite often, that if you do the best in a run of challenges or in a particular challenger, then you earn a wild card. However it's going to work, everybody does it differently. And I think that to put on a tournament, I do think it's fair enough to get a few free spots in the tournament. Yes, we sometimes see exploited, particularly in the Middle East, where we get some players that are, of course, nowhere near the level and don't win games. But once again, it's one spot. You know, it's often, you know, might be qualifying, it might be one spot in the main draw. I don't think it's a big problem. Okay, Andy Murray's had more wild cards than anybody, I think, on the ATP side. Because on the men's side, it's unlimited. Women's side, it's limited. You're not allowed to have as many as you want. So it's very different. But for the men, you can just rack them up. You can have a wild card every week if you want.
Didn't someone figure out that, I saw the social media, I didn't verify it. This might be loose facts. I know this is normally your area, but you have baby brain right now, so I'm taking over that mantle. But I think I read somewhere that, isn't it Petros Tsitsipas has had 98 wild cards?
I assume a lot of those are doubles, right?
Yeah, I would say 99% of them are doubles. But it's do you think it would be good if there was a limit? Or again, it's just up to the respective tournaments who they want to have on their courts?
Yeah, I think, I've always operated in the WTA system, which has had a limit. It's three main draw wild cards, three qualifying wild cards, one Grand Slam. So you can rack them up. You can still do quite a few.
Yeah.
But there is a limit, for example, particularly if you're an American player, you can't just get a wild card into every American event. You're only allowed three main draws, three qualifying, and then the US Open if you were to take that one. So I do think that a limit works, but I'm also not massively against somebody like Andy Murray just getting wild cards week in, week out. I don't see that as much of a problem. And if you're him, of course you're going to take them. You are never ever, some people suggesting that he shouldn't take it, you're never ever going to opt to play qualifying if you're Andy Murray and you're trying to protect your body at all costs. You will be like, excellent, I will take the place in the main draw and I will play this tournament, thank you very much.
And it's not like he hasn't done enough to deserve that place in the main draw. And one final thing, I don't know if you've read the Players' Tribune piece by Jessica Pegula about everything her mother went through when she suffered a cardiac arrest and how she's been playing through that and her mother's recovery. It was phenomenal to see what she's been going through and how she's been playing and having that switch of she's such a good talker, Jessica. I've interviewed her a couple of times. She's so lovely to speak to. Remember one press conference, she had her drinking from a can of beer. She just seems really normal, a really normal person. She's been such a, she has been a late bloomer in the sport in terms of the age when she really started making waves, but incredible. And I know I remember when Roberto Bautista Agut, he lost both of his parents, didn't he, in a relatively short space of time and battling through, but just a wonderful piece that she has just felt now that the time is right to talk about everything she's been battling off the court and then therefore on the court as well.
Yeah, really brutal with what they've gone through with her mum, and still plenty of difficult times ahead in terms of recovery. It's so difficult, isn't it? You know, I think it was so brilliantly written. It was such a nice insight into how difficult it is to make decisions. Do you then travel to go to tournaments? She, you know, had to go and play at Wimbledon, and you're leaving your family behind, and, you know, considering, well, do I just stop tennis and do I just take up the family business? Because they do have a huge business, of course, out in the States, and her mum playing, you know, such a critical role. In it, and all those things go through your mind, right? Do you give up your dream to facilitate that, or, you know, the direction you go in? I mean, how she's ended the world ended the year at world number three is, you know, quite astonishing. I don't know. Maybe there's some sort of escapism in the matches, or some sort of detachment that she can bring and use, because we have seen phenomenal tennis from her. Good for her for sort of. Getting it off her chest. She said it was time. I'm sure she's going to feel much better now that it's sort of all out in the open and she's explained things.
Yeah, I'd recommend, if people haven't, do search for it. It's a piece written on the Players' Tribune. And I should say a massive thank you to you, because you're not long through completing your family of four and you're back here podding. So massive thank you for... I didn't expect it. I thought we were chatting like congratulations baby stuff, but I thought I'm not going to ask about the pod. I'm not going to pressure you to get back podding until you're ready. So I love the fact that you felt ready.
Yeah, exactly. So if you've heard some little squeaks, it's because she's right next to the microphone. So I haven't been able to stop that, I'm afraid.
Can I say she's been wonderfully quiet, well behaved for the recording of this pod, which we massively appreciate. And look, the tennis, it never stops. We've got. Have you watched any more of Breakpoint? I've got to stop calling it Point Break because that was the surfing.
I have. I've watched it all. Well, all the ones that are out so far. I don't think the next episodes are there. So yeah, I found it really interesting. I found it. You know, as I said before, it's not aimed at us. It's not giving us insight into the world of tennis. It's giving people who have no idea. Insight into the world of tennis. So I thought it was well done. I definitely have some issues to pick at, which maybe we can do next week. I think just some just in terms of the way it sort of pans out. But then I don't know, tennis is just such a different sport. I think it's fascinating hearing from all the coaches. That's been really interesting, hearing a lot from Paul Annacombe when he was working with Taylor Fritz, and those sorts of discussions, with Paul Annacombe being like, don't play on your ankle. What are you doing? Please don't play. But ultimately, you have no control over your player. Your player goes out and then beats Nadal to win Indian Wells. So there you go.
Oh, I love this. It's okay. So Breakpoint to be continued. Is that it?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do a deep dive next week.
Okay. I'll speak to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.